From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour has been made throughout the pandemic. Local child advocates say that kids in our community, especially kids who are in disadvantaged situations, need more support. They're particularly concerned about kids' mental health. Data from 2020 shows that Rochester, Buffalo, and Syracuse are three of 13 cities where COVID-19 vulnerability and poor mental health overlap. Combine that with high rates of poverty in Rochester, the impact of stay-at-home orders early in the pandemic, violence in the community, and it leaves local children's health advocates increasingly worried about the mental and behavioral health needs among the community's children. So what do those needs look like? What supports and services could change things? Is it getting easier with more kids simply back in school, or what other gaps are there? And who should be leading the charge? This hour, our guests examine those gaps in service and make their recommendations for how to increase access to care. Let's welcome our guest, Bridget Hurley, Senior Director of Advocacy and Program for the Children's Agenda. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Evan.
Sarah Taylor is a parent advocate and founder of the BIPOC Parent Mental Health Project. Sarah, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Fleedner is here, Director of the PAIR and PAMI Programs for Disability Rights New York. We'll talk about what those acronyms mean coming up. Mark, thanks for being on the line with us.
Sure thing. Great to be here.
Sarah, let me just start with you because you're the founder of this group, and I know it's the last 3 years, not just during the pandemic, there's been a lot of things happening in your family. Can you tell us a little bit of that story, and then we'll talk about maybe especially what the last year and a half been like?
Sure. Thank you again, Evan. You know, having a child that is sick with a mental health diagnosis, there is often a lot of shame and guilt. A lot of emotions associated with it, in addition to navigating a very, very complex system that is not necessarily what it looks like on paper to actually walk through the mental health system on long wait lists, to be talked down to even just the language in non-culturally responsive care. And this has been a 3-year journey of us navigating the system, very, very complex condition that she has. And with that complex condition, also, there has been a number of providers involved. And so with a number of providers involved, there comes a lot of complexities. There are policies, there are practices, there are heightened levels of inequities, particularly for children of color. And for myself, who is a trained social worker and former administrator, the complexity and the frustration and the humiliation walking and navigating for advocating for my child has literally changed my life. It has been hard, a hard journey. It has been a frustrating journey. And on top of that, the societal stigma associated with mental health and blatantly, even in the medical and psychiatric system, children in this community that have medical conditions are treated totally different than children that have psychiatric conditions.
Let me tell you about something that caught my eye this week, and I want to explore a little bit more of maybe what is going to be new to people, which is thinking about mental health, even depression, at younger ages than we're sometimes used to. So I saw a post on social media of a woman who had taken a picture of herself. It looked like she was sitting on her bathroom floor, and the rings around her eyes, you could see she'd been crying. And she wrote that. She said, "I'm not going to play this game where everything on Facebook is roses." She said, "I'm going to open up about something that a lot of people don't know about," which is that she has two children. And she said, one, the 10-year-old, has depression, and some weeks are very, very hard. And there's a lot of tears and a lot of pain, a lot of worry for her future, and a lot of fear, frustration with the system. And for the people who knew this mother, it was a bit of a shock, because sometimes, first of all, social media is where there's often a sort of buffed up images to begin with. But also, you know, the kids are pretty young. And the idea of the sort of these fully formed mental health challenges, as opposed to just, you know, sort of young kids being young kids. People were very supportive in the response, but I think there was some concern and wanting to understand more. And she said, yeah, you know, I mean, you don't think about it often until perhaps until it's your child. And it can be really frightening, and it can be really, really hard. And had a lot of people thinking about that. Now, this is a parent of probably a lot of relative privilege, but just realistically, I think people were thinking, wow, 9, 10 years old, that's... So can you take me through what it was like for you when, especially in the last 3 years, when, you know, you go from seeing a child growing up and, you know, the single digit years are sort of their own, each year is a little different, but then as they move toward adolescence, it's very different. And what that's like as a parent to really try to get your head around, how do I help? What am I worried about? What do they understand about it? What does the society understand about it?
Yes, thank you for that. It's very emotional. You have to, as a parent, take a step back and not blame yourself. Because as mm-hmm. I said, a lot of guilt, shame, and blame. And really looking at this as not a behavioral health issue. Behavior issue that often when we're talking about Black and brown children living in poverty often happens instead of looking them at this situation as you got a sick child. You got a sick child that you want to be able to understand the language of what the doctors are saying, understand this from a physical, physiological perspective, and even when it comes to mental health, understanding the terminology, understanding what it is, understanding when your child, as people often say, has a meltdown, or some children that are really ill begin to cut themselves or bite on their fingers and exhibit high symptoms of anxiety. You want to know what that is. That is not easy to understand. So having a patient pediatrician for myself that was able to work with me, because it typically starts at schools or in the pediatrician offices. So really having a pediatrician that would communicate with me, but most of all, that would listen to me as a parent and not just deem, well, she's just bad. But listen and listen to what I'm saying about the behaviors, about the symptoms, about what we're going through, about her not being able to focus. So really, for me, you know, in the early stages, having a great relationship with a pediatrician. And when we often talk about children in poverty, Evan, most children are in some clinic where they may see, you know, two different doctors each time they go. But having an established relationship when we look at from a system perspective and early on is really important, the role of the pediatrician. And I think also culturally, I struggled because, you know, growing up, having that stigma associated, there was often, when we talk about mental health, it's often portrayed in society like something is wrong with you, something bad is wrong with you, it's not okay, versus this child is sick, this child needs the highest level of care and supports possible. So I think one of the things that I really struggle with over the last 3 years that shocked me was, as from a systems, a mental health systems perspective and a societal perspective, of still the levels of blame on the child, blame on the family.
The idea that, for lack of a better phrase, society is going to look at your child and say, that's a bad kid.
Yes, absolutely.
That's a fear for you?
That's fair. It's a huge fear. And even watching the last 6 months of her symptoms get even worse and very different, aggressive, unsafe behaviors, one of the biggest fears I have, which statistically we're starting to see numbers, particularly of low-income children of color, how many are that are go from the mental health system to the criminal justice system and the juvenile justice system. And that's always a fear of mine and a concern, is her symptoms and behaviors associated with the symptoms going to be criminalized. And I have, unfortunately, went through several mental hygiene arrests that were not pretty, and we're talking about a little child, we cannot continue allow mental health to be criminalized. And just you talking about that report that came out in October jumped out to me. Mm-hmm. And we became very strong with our advocacy, with saying, who is paying attention to this report that came out in October about Rochester being a triple threat due to our high poverty numbers? And we cannot continue. We have to treat mental health as a medical condition, and prioritize funding and prioritize strategies with the parent voice. And that's what our project is all about, hearing from parents, and particularly parents of color that are not openly going to talk about it. I did not want to publicly say I've been through mental hygiene rest, that I had somewhat of Jerry Springer shows in my house. That's embarrassing to talk about. And as we have the groups in 14621, 14605, in the heart of the cities, there are families that are embarrassed and don't want to talk about because they know that stigma and the levels of perceptions about their children being bad and criminals versus children that are ill.
Your daughter is so lucky to have you. I hope your family doesn't feel embarrassed or shame. And I'm really appreciate you being here to talk through where we need to go next. But one more question looking back is that, what did the pandemic do to a situation that was already difficult?
Because we needed a higher level of care, you know, I think for myself, as well as hearing from families, you know, it put an added level of stress. You know, when we talk about the pandemic and children learning remotely that may already have anxiety disorders, mm-hmm. and we're saying they got to sit at a computer, or they can't go outside and run, they can't interact with their peers. And I think for families, the fear of not knowing what is going to happen with their jobs. And I think for myself, you know, having some restrictions in seeing her and our level of engagement early on was very, very hard. And just a number of factors that came with the pandemic. And you have to realize, in the middle of the pandemic, we also had what we've seen what happened in this community with George, we've seen nationally with George Floyd, and then we've seen with Daniel Prude. And so you're talking to a parent that has been through mental hygiene arrest, that know very well, has experienced, not to that extent, but has seen some things that were not okay. And so I think the added levels of stress for families that have children that are already have IEPs, special education services, and that many of our community organizations and districts were not able to fully meet those needs, particularly children with disabilities.
Yeah, I think we struggled for a while, and we're still struggling to do it. And it's understandable that we would struggle with trying to understand, okay, COVID is a threat, but keeping kids away from classrooms is a threat in a different way. Does one sort of outweigh the other? When can we, you know, sort of make changes? I'm not saying that's easy. I'm not at all casting blame, but I am hearing your story, and it's tough because, you know, you're already dealing with the struggles that you were in your family, and all of a sudden less engagement, less contact. Is there improvement or hope? Would that a lot of kids are now at least back in a classroom together? They're seeing one another, not necessarily just through screens anymore. Does that help?
I think hearing from the families we work with, it does help. Mm-hmm. But you have to remember, we already, prior to the pandemic, had a very vulnerable children's mental health system. So on top of the pandemic, so as Bridget in the Children's Agenda often advocates for, we need more culturally responsive mental health services a part of the school system, as well as community base that's not afraid to go into the neighborhoods. We know we had telehealth, it worked well, but we also know when it comes to this topic, when it comes to interacting with families around mental health, having that face-to-face, having that individual, that professional, or that peer, that other parent to say, I've been there, is really helpful for families and children.
Bridget Hurley is the Senior Director of Advocacy and Program for the Children's Agenda. These stories are hard to hear, but it's important that we hear them because Sarah's story is so far and away from the only story like it, and she knows that, and we all know that. What is the perspective of the children's agenda for what happens next year, whether that is programs, resources, funding, et cetera? What do you want to see?
Well, what we'd like to see is more of what works for kids and what does make a difference in kids' lives. And we know that. So that's the hope. That's the positive, is that there's evidence about what does support children and families as they're going through a mental health crisis or a chronic mental health condition. What we need are the resources. But again, there's hope, because there's hundreds of millions of dollars coming into this community through COVID relief and the federal government. And that's one of the reasons why we are circulating this petition requesting that some of those funds in our CSD be used for mental health supports. So we have the solutions. We have the resources. We need the will. We need the intention. We need the attention of community leaders to say these things need to be addressed. It's not a new problem, as Sarah said. I mean, I remember years ago talking about the lack of mental health providers in this community and beyond. And so we have some tough things to face, but we do have some hope.
What does the RCSD say about this? I mean, you're advocating, you're saying, look, there's millions of dollars coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that this is not a continual stream. There may be one-shots here. There may be mm-hmm. decisions that have to be made one time with some of this money. You're saying some of that's got to be used to increase support for mental health services, especially in RCSD. What does the district say?
The district is actually making some investments with their COVID dollars. They're not making what we had recommended and what we think is going to be necessary. I also just want to also correct. So the COVID dollars from the federal government are limited to the next 3 or 4 years, must be spent. I think 2024 is the farthest we're going to be able to go with some of the COVID dollars, as we understand it right now.
Sure.
There may be some extensions. But in New York State, there was a tremendous victory with foundation aid in the 21-22 state budget. And so there will be ongoing increased resources for RCSD every year through foundation aid and through state aid. And so there'll be more resources, you know, looking ahead that could be invested as well.
Sarah, what's your message for the district?
I think for the city school district, particularly because they serve a number of children in poverty, as well as the suburban school districts, it must be a priority. It must be a priority. And parents, they need to hear from parents. We have two main large healthcare organizations in this community that the districts and others often look to when it comes to mental health. My position has and will always be, you need to come to the parents and ask them what works for them. What would they like to see? Because we have seen major gaps, even in many institutions that have some deep-rooted systemic issues that are not able to fully meet the needs of children in color around mental health services, and particularly outreach. You can't do outreach in low-income communities for children of color around mental health from the offices. You just can't. You have to have that grassroots, neighborhood-based approach. And many of our healthcare systems will not do that. And until we're ready to change the system itself and really allow parents, many of our parents are on, like myself, invited to advisory boards. I often take a step back from advisory boards because you give them suggestions, you give them ideas. And for me, it becomes a check the box to say a parent was there. But we need to see parents driving policy, driving strategy, and from organizations like districts and like your University of Rochester, like your Rochester Regional, that they're not just having peer parents on staff, but they have parents driving the services and hearing from parents.
Are there resources or approaches that over, especially the last 3 years, you've come to recognize do work for your child?
There has been some resources. I have hired a private clinician mm-hmm. and have looked at some models from out of state, advocating to bring some of those interventions in. And it's pretty, our situation has been very, very complicated. And like I said, I have a very sick child, but I'm hopeful. I am hopeful. And as I hear from other parents, we do see there are models around the country. But I continue to say we have to really understand if we're talking about children in poverty, which we know our numbers in this community, we have to invest in culturally responsive and responses that meet the needs around socioeconomic conditions.
We're going to bring in Mark Fleedner and want to let you know here that there is an event. It's a free community roundtable as part of Children's Interfaith Weekend, and that's tomorrow from 11 to 1. It's happening at Newborn Fellowship Church on North Clinton in Rochester. They'll have parents, advocates, experts talking about mental health and the impact on children, especially families who've struggled with poverty. And they're asking you to register. It's BIPOCParentVoice.org, I think. That's correct, sir. BIPOCParentVoice.org.
Absolutely. They can find information in the email to register.
And I know you've got speakers lined up. What are you most looking forward to?
Really hearing from some of the experts, Dr. Myra Mathis, who is a psychiatrist and also a graduate of the City School District that has done a lot of work around equity in mental health. She is a renowned expert, and we're lucky to have her here locally. We also have some parents talking about their journey and support, and some other experts that are going to talk about interventions that really have worked nationally for the Latinx community, refugee engagement. So we have a number and some parents that are going to share their journey to help other parents.
Who should be there? Parents worried or concerned about their
parents,
kids?
Parents, faith leaders. We definitely want parents there. We want faith leaders there, particularly because we know faith leaders are trusted. They are trusted community advocates out there, and they don't often necessarily understand the depth of mental health. So this is a learning opportunity for faith leaders, stakeholders, and community advocates that have an interest.
Mark Fleedner with Disability Rights New York, how do you see this issue right at this moment? What are the most pressing needs from your perspective?
Yeah, well, this is a great opportunity for us. I'm coming at this from a slightly different perspective than Sarah and Bridget, but a very compatible and cooperative perspective. I'm the director. You cited our acronyms. I'm the director of two programs that are statewide. One of them is to provide legal advocacy to any folks, including children and their families, who have mental health diagnoses, and then to provide services for those who have physical disabilities and need their individual rights protected. So we're looking at it from a broader system perspective, but I have to tell you that the data that you referenced in the beginning of the program, I can tell you anecdotally, we're hearing all the time that a already difficult system with conflicting systems that don't match each other and don't support each other was exacerbated significantly over the course of the last year and a half, 2 years because of COVID. And we're hearing the stories from folks like Sarah. I don't frankly know of a better sort of both professional and lived experience reporter than Sarah Taylor. And so she's been a great source of information to us. And I look forward to having the same kind of exchanges with Bridget, but you have parents who are calling us and are saying, I have done the homework, even though these systems are entirely new to me, but I'm dealing with OMH, Office of Mental Health at the state level. I'm dealing with the Rochester school system. I'm dealing with, federal agencies that are trying to provide funding. And the systems are not working compatibly together. It's not only that there are gaps, there are sometimes actually conflicts in the way that they're describing what kids need. My quick answer to what DRNY feels is so important, I hope that Sarah and Bridget agree, is that we really focus on the community-based services that can be provided by great, motivated Rochester residents, but supported by foundation monies as well as state and federal funding. Because when kids become institutionalized, either, as Sarah mentioned, in the context of the criminal law system, or in the context of psychiatric facilities where they're in congregate care settings where they tend to be secluded and certainly isolated in ways that are just absolutely counterproductive, we need to be investing our time and resources into how to integrate folks into the community and then sustain their community residential support systems.
Right now, Mark, you know, we've got talk about what school districts are doing. I've read stories, a wide range sort of approaches, especially with kids and mental health, kids who've been out of school, kids who've been sort of disconnected. Many, many kids, as Sarah said, who weren't very engaged, especially in the early part of the pandemic. And there was a lot of concern about, you know, what was going to happen to them. And from San Francisco to Omaha to Rochester, different approaches. Are you right now feeling like this is a community, this is a state, this is a region that sort of gets it and is moving in that direction? Or is it still sort of detached where there's a silo here and a problem here and people not talking to each other? I mean, I'm curious to know sort of how you see that big picture right now.
Okay, well, the great news that I have to tell you is, and part of the reason I was so motivated to join you today, is that the parent, the family, the grassroots energy that I'm seeing most forcefully throughout the state is coming from the Rochester region, including the folks on this call. So that's a great thing, but it's still a challenge, as my colleagues here know, on translating that to the policymakers, the policy deciders, to make the investment. And again, it's not just Rochester coughing up the money through its budget. It's creative, strategic management of the federal and state funding that's coming in and other, you know, sources of funding to look ahead. I appreciate your bringing COVID into the mix. I mean, we had kids who were already prior before any of us ever knew what the word COVID-19, you know, was going to mean in our lives. We had kids who were more isolated than they'd ever been because of the use of social media and what that does to the brain and what that does to the social life and all that. Being isolated from each other, with other people, us, right, who are doing our best as parents to try and to keep our heads above water while isolated in the last year and a half has been extraordinarily detrimental. And what is a state problem that I'm very focused on, in fact, it caused me to rethink what we refer to as our priorities and objectives at Disability Rights New York, is emergency preparedness. Is not something that it cannot be reactive. If we do not take this moment in time and carefully do a postmortem on what worked and what didn't, and learn from that experience and incorporate it into the way all of these systems work or don't work together, we are not only missing an incredible opportunity, but we are leaving ourselves unprepared for the next emergency, of which there will be one. There will be a public health emergency. There will be a natural, you know, weather emergency. And I find that you see New York State looking all the time for a moment at the crises of the moment and then turning on to other things. We do not have the luxury of doing that. Emergency preparedness with people with disabilities and their families who are impacted at the table is something that has to keep getting discussed, and it has to be continually rediscussed as we learn more from the process.
Yeah, there's a note from a listener that I'll read in just a second that reflects exactly that, and I think it responds to something that Sarah said. But one more point with you, Mark, just briefly, when you talk about these lessons that must be learned in this sort of post or ongoing mortem of what's happening, especially from the last 18 months, what's the most important lesson that you fear might not be learned or might be overlooked?
I think the most important lesson is what Sarah so graphically described, which is that the systems are not compatible. And parents who are trying to deal with kids who are having mental health issues or any kind of a disability challenge in the system, the systems, federal, state, and local, and I guess it really is driven by the locals to make sure that this is all in line, have to be compatible with each other so that Sarah Taylor does not have to go through some of the things that she's gone through in the last year. And by the way, that includes our insurance systems. So it's that global view. It's that view of the fact that Office of Mental Health and the school systems and all of those have to look at each other's policies and procedures and make sure that they are compatible and make sure that they're not leaving a parent like Sarah, you know, pulling her hair out and experiencing far more trauma than she would just by virtue of the fact that her family's in mental health crisis.
Yeah, there's a phrase that we, producer Megan Mack especially, and I repeat to each other often when we're talking about how to have conversations appropriately, how to really learn. And in the disability rights community, that phrase is nothing about us without us. So when you hear when you hear Sarah say that, you know, you're thinking, you've thought about kind of pulling back from joining boards or, you know, some of these groups because some of your experience was, well, they want to check a box and say they got a parent, but it didn't feel like this is an effective way to deal with problems. They're still not getting to the root of the problem. It's still detached in a boardroom as opposed to where it needs to be in the community. John writes to say, Evan, what your guest is saying about authentic parent engagement resonates deeply with me. We can't just be checkbox participants with regard to school governance and leadership, end quote. Is some of this well-meaning, or do you think too often it's, hey, we got a parent on the board, you know, status quo continues?
I think, you know, many systems like mental health and office with people with disabilities have become very, very strong with a parent voice and saying to providers, you need to incorporate the parent voice. Many providers have peer advocates. But the reality is when it comes to the power, when it comes to the power structures, very little parent power in the policy and decision making. And I can tell you, I refuse to sit on some advisory boards now where I sit and give ideas and suggestions and they will pick and choose what they want. And then when we talk about advisory boards and you bring the whole cultural and ethnicity to it, there's a whole heightened level of distrust. So here we have systems setting policies for Black and brown children living in poverty when there may be a handful of parents, when we have thousands of children in this community and parents that we're not hearing from because they don't have the trust and they have not been engaged appropriately. They're not at the table, not because they don't want to. So many times we're deemed not engaged, non-compliant. Well, are you coming to us, meeting us where we are? And that's why I'm standing strong in our advocacy. This project is parent-led, and we're not going to compromise when it comes to policies and strategies that we're saying needs to be driven by parents. Not an insurance, not a provider that wants to cut corners or say they don't want to go in the heart of the city to do outreach, but really the strategies need to be driven with parent input at the top.
You're hearing Sarah Taylor, who's a parent advocate and the founder of the project she's talking about, the BIPOC Parent Mental Health Project. And the conversation this hour is about kids' mental health. Yes, during the pandemic, but this is not just a pandemic conversation. Certainly the pandemic exacerbated some issues and maybe brought more attention, perhaps. But it's a question that existed well before the pandemic. And now the question going forward is what really needs to be done, particularly for kids, kids of color, kids who are in more vulnerable situations. If you want to register for an event tomorrow from 11 to 1, go to the website BIPOC, that's B-I-P-O-C, BIPOCParentVoice.org. The event is free. It's a community roundtable from 11 to 1 at Newborn Fellowship Church. And you heard Bridget Hurley earlier this hour mention the petition. After we check our only break of the hour now, Bridget's the Senior Director of Advocacy and Program for the Children's Agenda. We're going to talk about what's on that petition and maybe some of the specifics that could still be addressed in our community. Bridget's here. Sarah's here. Mark Fleedner from Disability Rights New York is with us as well. We continue after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we continue our conversations with candidates for Rochester City Council. We've invited every candidate on the ballot to talk about their priorities for the city. Then in our second hour, local breast cancer experts say there's misinformation being circulated about when to have mammograms. We talk about the latest in screening and treatment for breast cancer, especially during the pandemic.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important best told, sometimes off the beaten path, news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me read a note from a listener named Isaac who says, Evan, I'm a clinical social worker in private practice who has also worked in agencies and clinics previously in my career. I agree 100% with your panel about many of the systemic issues regarding children and families, particularly children of color, those living in poverty, obtaining access to mental health services. From a provider perspective, we experience many problems when working in these systems: inadequate compensation, unrealistic expectations for providing care, high rates of burnout, and more. I could say a lot more, but we don't have enough time. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to increase access, especially from a systems perspective at all levels. That's from Isaac. Mark Fleedner, what do you make of that?
Amen. You have really smart listeners who are obviously sharing their lived experiences, and I simply couldn't agree with more with his perspective.
Sarah, anything you want to say about that?
Absolutely. When we talk about the system level, in addition, we have been out there. We have been out there since the fall as parents before we got funding through the Greater Rochester Health Foundation and Wilson Foundation. But from a systems perspective, and I know many of our listeners understand the poverty simulator, and what we developed, Evan, is the framework for a mental health systems change simulator from the lens of a parent. So we're going to be rolling that out in the community, inviting parents to be a part of this planning for it. And really, because it has to start at a system level. We can talk about community-based outreach. We can talk about provider. But until we're addressing the systems level, we're just going to keep revolving around. And for me, you know, Evan, it's not about outcomes. It's about lives. We don't even know the magnitude, honestly, when we're talking about children of color who's committing suicide. I don't think we have an accurate count, but we know statistically we're seeing those numbers go up. So for me, this is not about numbers. This is about lives.
Well, John writes to say, I am a teacher, and your guests are 100% correct about advisory committees and what the school districts really want. They do not want real participation. And eventually, people walk away or give up because they get jerked around for so long. The term in the district for this is death by inches. Whew. That's tough. But I mean, that's one of the, I know you're, that's a maybe the extreme way of describing it. But essentially, you've been saying you're not going to tolerate that. That's what this new project you're working on is designed to change, isn't it?
Absolutely. We have two core strategies of our project: to develop a network. When we say BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, People of Color. However, we've heard from suburban parents that are white, that are raising children of color, and said, we are seeing the discrimination. We are seeing the disparities. So we're helping families that are not just families of color, but raising children of color, to build a network. Your traditional mental health advocacy groups do great work. However, when it comes to communities of color, they're not out there necessarily in the heart of the neighborhoods, particularly our high poverty census tracts. And our second core strategy is to build a system meant for our children. We are providing provider training, which that has never been heard of, Evan. Us going into a couple of the series of trainings, we've been training pediatricians, we've been training nurses, social workers, counselors, cultural humility, racial equity from the lens of a parent. Hearing, helping them hear what it's like for me to walk into a clinic or a facility to say, oh, your child is bad, or she was coming over here to cause trouble. You know, that often raises eyes. And I said, oh, yeah, I've heard this language in so-called trauma-informed settings. So we have strategies to train providers from the parent lens, which is a new model that we want to train providers. What works for us, how we want to be communicated to, how we want to be supported. So we're going in to train them from our lens.
Well, I mentioned the petition, and Bridget Hurley, before we get into that, Bridget's here from the Children's Agenda. Bridget was stressing during the break here, this is not the be-all, end-all that will fix everything. And I know you want to make that point before we get into what the petition says.
Right. Well, so first of all, I think a couple of us have mentioned that this did not start with the pandemic. And I have my own personal experience pre-pandemic of trying to seek mental health care for one of my children. And I have health insurance. I have a working vehicle. I have actually connections in the mental health field. And still, I was told it'll be 6 to 8 weeks. It'll be 12 weeks just for an appointment, an outpatient appointment with a therapist. So, and even more disturbing, I think, is that many of the therapists I spoke with, and I know this is still true, have given up on the insurance system. So they're just seeing families who can pay them out of pocket. And that's, you know, we're talking about $100 an hour.
Absolutely.
Week after week. So,
yeah.
So pre-existing situation, research that we did years ago, and again, I know this is still true. It's a lot of it's around the lack of providers, which speaks to the reimbursement issue that was brought up earlier, that, you know, child psychiatrists are one of the poorest paid medical fields, and so is not attracting lots of folks. So issue with lack of providers. And then on top of it, we have the pandemic, which I just want to be very clear. There's children who have had almost no contact with caring adults since this began. There are hundreds of children literally missing from the school. I'm familiar with the city school district. I don't think that it's unique that there are children who just aren't on anybody's radar anymore. Mom and dad are either out working or, you know, unstable themselves. And so I feel like on top of an already stressed system, we now are asking care for children who have been isolated and are lacking supports, like you said, Evan, around school. They're
not
seeing
pediatricians. Even now with RCSD in many districts back in
Absolutely.
Person, you mean now.
Yeah. But there's kids missing right now, and there's not nearly enough support right now. So so just in that context, of course, the school system is an important support for kids, again, in Rochester and around the county. And so we are asking the school district to step up with the funds that they've received through COVID relief to do more. So first of all, every child needs a check-in daily, you know, from an adult to say, how you doing today? And then there needs to be screening. A culturally sensitive, responsive screening. And then we get to the petition, which is, okay, now you have a sense of what the needs are. And so what we're suggesting is that $30 million, again, in the city school district be devoted to restorative practices, which we know really work to support kids and reduce violence and are a great way to resolve disputes that come up in a way that does not lead to violence and does not lead to suspensions. So definitely expanded restorative practices in every school, including peace circles led by parents and students. We know the help zones help tremendously so that a child who is feeling anxious or depressed can literally leave a classroom and walk down the hall and be in a safe place with a trained adult who can help them work through what they're going through. And, you know, sometimes that child in a half hour is back at school and doing fine. So those are really, really important. And some of these things were very popular years ago and have eroded. And so we're here to say...
Is that one of them, help zones?
There's been cuts in help zones. Right.
Just because budgets are tight or do people not believe in them?
Well, I don't know if you remember, but right before the pandemic, there were some very serious issues in the Rochester City School District. And so lots of things got cut, including contracts with agencies who were staffing these help zones. And then there's been cuts in just staff, social workers and counselors. And so many of those folks are working. There's so few of them. They work almost exclusively with the special ed population, which, of course, is important. But that does not leave a lot of room for, again, a child who's experiencing anxiety and trauma that does not have an IEP. The peace circles, as I said, really important. And then finally, every effort needs to be made to hire folks who reflect the students that they're serving, because we do know that that makes a big difference.
And that's, first of all, there's almost no school district in the country that's a public school district that has a racial reflection that is equal in terms of demographic proportion to students. It's always more white teachers per capita. Very few teachers of color in suburban districts. Even in Rochester, it's way out of whack. And when it comes to mental health support, other professionals, Sarah, I see you nodding right along. How much does this make an impact?
It makes an impact. We see it in the mental health system. We can go into our largest healthcare systems and see maybe two or three clinicians of color. Many, as one of the individuals that wrote in, many clinicians of color get frustrated and are frustrated themselves with the deep-rooted systemic issues within some of the organization. So very, we see them as frontline workers. And Bridget and I were talking earlier, particularly in the mental health system, whether it's residential or community-based, you have the staff there, develop them. You can't tell me that many of our residential facilities that have frontline workers of color may not be interested in learning some clinical skills. And I think also looking at the mental health profession continuum, we know that paramodels are powerful. We know that lived experience is powerful. So we have to look at who we actually consider the professionals when we're looking at mental health, because many of our mental health organizations do not reflect the populations they serve.
I do think when you talk about, Bridget talks about the fact that there was that devastating set of cuts and changes right before the pandemic, January of 2020. You know, you had hundreds, if not thousands, of kids literally leave for holiday break and come back to new classrooms and new teachers, which is, you can't even imagine how difficult that is in a normal, like, you know, sort of like in the course of a year, you come back and there's new people in the building, et cetera. But in the course of right in the middle of a school year, whew, that has got to be very, very difficult. Then you think about kids who are struggling already with mental health challenges, mm-hmm. Maybe needing academic supports, and you're starting from scratch with a new relationship building. I always think, Mark Fleeter, I always think it's sort of cliche, but it's true that budgets are a reflection of priorities. And whenever you see necessary cuts, it's usually a tell of, like, what are your non-negotiables, you know? And so to hear that, for example, help zones or some of these supports, mental health supports, counselors, some or many might have been lost. Even when there's a crunch, I get it, it's a crunch, but to me it's still a statement of priorities, and I wonder how you see that.
I following back on both Bridget and Sarah said, as well as the comment from your last write-in listener, the culture that we choose is reflected in the choices that we make, and that includes the budget choices that we make. You know, we're talking about the woefully inadequate pay for teachers, clinicians. You know, it's very difficult to get folks to take certain jobs because we deprioritize the value of their jobs, and we also have this problem because when we, as advocates, are reaching out to ingrained systems, whether it be the school system or the state budget system or whatever it is, you know, all of these bureaucracies, they tend to immediately think, how does what this person's proposing fit into my bureaucratic box? When what Bridget and Sarah are talking about, and I'd like to think DRNY is doing too and supporting, is thinking outside the box. I mean, Sarah was talking about new vocations, you know, utilizing the logical skill sets that folks who are already doing some of this work have to come up with creative ideas. And bureaucracies don't tend to think that way. Mm-hmm. So that's why this parent energy and this nonprofit and, you know, grassroots energy is so critical. But it has to go beyond, and this is a great opportunity for us to be talking about it in your forum, and I think we all appreciate it. It has to go from the community into some of these, you know, boardrooms and actually, you know, legislative chambers sometimes. And we have to ensure that the bureaucracies understand that they have to shift. They have to change based upon the changing needs in order to create the culture that Rochester residents want.
Well, before we lose the hour, let me just remind listeners, if you can go to BIPOCParentVoice.org if you want to register for the event tomorrow that's happening at the Newborn Fellowship Church on North Clinton in Rochester from 11 to 1. It's a free community roundtable. They would love to see parents there along with, I mean, so many people that we've been talking about this hour who are concerned about the mental health of kids in our community, resources, approaches, making sure representation and voices are heard. So it's a big event tomorrow. The Children's Event Agenda has the petition we've been talking about on their website if you want to check that out. And Sarah, in our last couple of minutes, I would love to hear from you on, you know, sort of how you feel like parents who don't have your background of advocacy, who are just going to be new to this, who are just starting to navigate understanding, boy, my child, you use the word sick for your child. They're getting sort of their heads around the idea that my child is sick. I don't have a bad kid. I have a kid who may be sick or having mental health struggles, et cetera. But there's a lot of fear. What message would you share with them, considering, you know, they're hearing from you and you're quite experienced already in advocacy and thinking about these? What would you share with them?
I think, you know, just not beating up on themselves. I think that's important. What have I done? That was my question. Was something wrong with my parenting skills?
It's hard not to go there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so hard not to go there. And, you know, again, the stigma, you know, associated with is still very prevalent. And so being able to reach out to a peer, reach out to a support group and talk to another parent. I can tell you, you know, when we had our support groups that we started in the city and I start sharing some of my experience, parents opened up and said, oh my gosh, you went through that. But they weren't going to publicly talk about it. So I think it's important to reach out to those support circles. And that way you will see you're not alone. You're not alone. And it's so important to, you know, take notes to in your own language and advocate at the pediatrician office, because so many times we hear about medication is the answer. For some, it may be. For others, it may not be. But to really begin to talk to the doctor, if a doctor won't listen, talk to a nurse. It is so important to find someone to talk about. And I often found that having that individual with lived experience that was there that say, I mean, I can't tell you how many times up in psychiatric emergency rooms, I was there for hours and would go up to other parents that had tears in their eyes, like myself, and just start having a conversation. Is this your first time here? And they would look at me and say, yes. And I would just sit and talk to them about this journey. You know, get ready to be here for 24 hours. And it's tough, Evan. I could tell you just the tears, the heartache, the shame. And often, you know, our jobs are on the line at times. So it's a lot. It's really heavy.
All the love to your family and good luck to you. Your child, and I know there's so many people listening who may not have be publicly sharing their stories like you are, but you're right. There's a lot of people who are experiencing this, and I think there will be a lot of solidarity in events like tomorrow and going forward. Good luck this weekend. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Taylor is a parent advocate, the founder of the BIPOC Parent Mental Health Project. Bridget Hurley, Senior Director of Advocacy and Program for the Children's Agenda. Thank you, Bridget.
Thank you.
And Mark Fleedner from Disability Rights New York. Mark, great having you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This is the final day of our fall membership campaign. We hope you are a member of Public Radio and support the whole team here. Megan Mack, Rob Braden, Evan Dawson, Emery Stein saying thanks for listening. Talk with you next week.